your faith in the 2 inches of hummus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields. Lie down in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest in your thoughts. As soon as the generals and politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. I love that poem. One of you, after a session, mentioned to me a book by Joan Chittister named The Gift of Years. And I don't know if you're familiar with this. I have seen the book, and it has been recommended to me in the past. I have not read it, but I know that Joan Chittister's work is great, so I am sure the book is very good as well. The Gift of Years. She herself is entering into her elder years, and is a Roman Catholic sister and a theologian, a very, very interesting woman. So I just wanted to pass that on as a bit of wisdom. I want to do something tonight that is a little different than what we've done so far, and that is, if you've each taken a piece of paper and have something to write with, I want to ask you to do a short exercise. It's an exercise that is going to challenge you to keep your pen to paper and just write for 7 minutes. I'm going to time it. And I'd like you to start what you write with this phrase, and then you complete it and continue with it in whatever way it goes, wherever it takes you. Just when I, or he, or she, or we, I suppose, just when I thought, dot, dot, dot. And I want you not to stop, not to go back and scratch things out and edit and make it perfect. If you get stuck somewhere along the way, just start again with just when. Maybe use that as a refrain throughout what you write. This is called free writing, and it's one of the exercises that writers use, but also that has been found to be a means by which, and I would, here, if you have someone who's just entered. We're doing an exercise that starts out with just when I thought, dot, 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 and I want you to write for 7 minutes on that. That's the basic instruction. If you're stuck on it, then begin again. But what I wanted to mention to you is that this is an exercise that has been used for caregivers, people who have been in positions of caring for people who are ill or in other kinds of situations where they are possibly burning out. They just it's overwhelming. And for them, once a week for 20 minutes to do a kind of free write exercise that helps them to focus in and to do it maybe with other people as well, has been found to be one of the two most helpful exercises that can be done to prevent burnout. The other is meditation on a regular basis, whether that's prayer or other kinds of meditation. But of the many things that people suggest, those two have been found to be the most effective. So I'm going to time you, and I'm going to do it with you as well. So task is start with that phrase and see where it takes you for 7 minutes. If someone comes in, I'll help them. This phrase here, yeah. Just when I or he or she thought. I don't know, just keep your pen to your paper for that moment. Okay, let's go. And then just stop. Okay. Did any of you end up in a surprising place in that exercise? Something happened that you wouldn't have anticipated, a memory that came up, an insight.
Yes.
Are you willing to just share briefly?
Yes. I started out talking about walking fast with a goal in mind and realizing I had to be careful about how I was walking.
Uh-huh.
And it reminded me of her daughter who was special needs and needed special attention to a training to walk so that she wouldn't fall or hurt herself.
Okay, so it brought you to that memory. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyone else willing to share something about that, where they went? I didn't know where I was going when I started, even though I invented this one, but I found myself in a valley, coming to a new place that I couldn't identify, with nothing in it that I'd experienced before, and yet it was familiar, and not just familiar to me individually, but familiar to generations of people before me, a place that was stone and parched with a trickle of water running through. And just when I began to recognize that this place was not foreign, not alien, but a place that would bring me to my knees, as it had so many others, I saw that the trickle of water was more than before, and it was more than I expected from an unknown source. Maybe it was the water of the Vespers or something that was coming in. Anyone else? Okay, you're we're not willing to trust. Okay. One of the things about this is that it is kind of an act of trust to put out there. Because you don't think it's good enough, you know, it wasn't insightful enough, possibly, you know, or special enough, what you did. But what I wanted to do was to try to get each of us into a place where you are thinking a little bit more about the being led into unexpected places. Because the experience of grief and the experience of accompanying those who are dying will do that. It will lead you into some new places that you may not be a bit prepared for, and yet maybe, as I found myself writing about, maybe they are places that somehow in the very depths of our humanity we have resources, unknown resources that will come forward, come out to assist us. One of the things that I wanted to do with you tonight, having just tried to get us into that space, is to talk a little bit with you about the process, what people go through as they're dying. And some of you have been with people when they have died. But I would like to just go through some of the physical and emotional changes that people do go through during that time. And to help you as a family member, a loved one, to accompany others, and then also to perhaps in some manner prepare yourself as well. But the things that happen that are physical can sometimes be confusing for those who are accompanying someone who is in the last hours, days, or hours of their life. And I thought it would be a helpful thing just to go over some of those things with you. And to also let you know if there's some things that you can do as a family member to assist someone as they are going through these stages. There's a certain amount of what we have termed in the work that I did anyway as active dying, where someone is in the actual final stages of their illness, and it's recognized that they are dying, but you can't ever tell how quickly that's going to happen. One of the things that happens is that a person's hands and feet begin to become cool. And the color of the skin may change to a kind of purplish or blue. It may become mottled and will begin to look different than when circulation is normal. It just means that your body is shutting down some. As a family member, you can massage the person's feet, massage the person's hands, do something to help you feel closer and to hopefully comfort the person that is coming to the end. There can be some disorientation of the dying person. And often family members think it's important to try to orient the person. It scares them when the person is disoriented. But sometimes that confusion is actually just a pleasant confusion, and there's nothing that one needs to do about that. If it seems to be... And you can kind of join them in it, if they're talking about sometime when they were a child as now, you just join them. And the main thing is there to join the emotional place that they're in, not necessarily the fact place, but, if they're remembering something warm and pleasant, join them in that feeling. Or if they're remembering something that they are sorry about or worried about, just kind of enter that emotion with them if you can for a while, and don't worry so much about getting them oriented back to the present. It's often the case that people will see those who have died before them. They will have visions of someone coming to meet them, or might describe quite, be like they're looking off. And that's a fairly common thing again, and it should not frighten you, those of you who are with the person. It simply means that the person is coming to the end of their journey, and it's usually a comforting thing for the person to see someone from their past, perhaps who has died before them. Has that happened for any of you as you've been with people? Is that there are some very touching moments there that can happen. If the person's agitated, it seems to be really agitated, that's not a good thing. And it can be addressed with medication, and you may want to alert someone or try to deal with that. It depends on if you're in a hospital or at home with hospice or what. But unnecessary agitation can be dealt with medically, so you don't have to go through that. There will be more and more sleeping, less and less time that the person is alert and awake. Another thing that tends to happen is that sometimes the person will really pull in and not want a lot of people around. And if you are the person that person needed to do with you has been done, please, just let it go then. and if they need someone else with them, they just need fewer and fewer people. On the other hand, if you have people gathered in another room, I mean, that's great. But you don't all have to be around the bed if it's a grandma or mother or something. You don't all have to be around at the time of death, or if it seems like a person is just withdrawing. That's very hard for those of us who love someone to see them withdraw from you, but it's very natural as people come to the end of their journey. So do not be taken aback by that. There will be changes in the breathing pattern, and there are basically three stages or types that you might observe. You would have normal breathing. You have what is called chain Stokes breathing, which is when the breathing basically stops for what seems to be sometimes almost a minute or more, and then there's a kind of big breath, and then normal breathing for a while, and then down again. And usually the times that are down just become longer and longer. Or there may be times that the person will have very short breathing, kind of panting and breathing, or very, very slow breathing. It's very hard for families to, I mean, first of all, it's very hard to be sitting there. Person has gone into one of these minute or longer no breathing, and to be sitting there and never knowing if this is going to be the last one. Very difficult on families, as you can imagine. But it's not hard on the patient. It's not hard on the person who's dying. It's a very natural process. And usually the end comes, there are very seldom any TV moments where the person says something amazing and then dies, it's usually much more of a kind of staged, simply ending. The, you know, it just doesn't take the next breath. And the other thing about it is that it's always a surprise. It's always a surprise, no matter how, you know, you're all there, you know the person's going to die, you've prepared yourself, you've been watching, and yet you didn't expect it to happen right then. And it's amazing to me why that always is the case, but it does seem very often to be the case. You just are never quite ready, even though you've been there waiting and waiting and waiting. There, as a person is dying, there will be physical changes, there will be incontinence and release of stool, the muscles are relaxing, there will be very, very little actually fluid discharge, urine discharge at the end. The systems are shutting down, they aren't producing a lot, and that's the other thing, you don't need to be encouraging a dying person to take fluids the way that you would if someone was trying to be cured, you know. They don't need them. And in fact, if you hydrate someone who is definitely dying, it's worse for them. It makes it a harder, make it a harder death, and they just kind of get bloated. Their body can't deal with it. So as much as our nurturing, I mean, this is another thing that families often want to do, is to try to, you know, it's a caring thing to do, you know. You feed people, you try to make them comfortable in that way. And so it's hard for families not to do that or to recognize that they don't have to, and in fact it's better perhaps if they don't try. It's a natural process, and it's all going, getting slower and slower, and less is needed. The urine will become more concentrated, be kind of a tea color rather than the normal color. If there's restlessness, it might be nice to know if the person is someone who's usually restless, who gets anxious. And if that's the case, you may want to mention that in turn to the medical people, if that's something that they should know, that that's just normal, that's the way she normally is. It might make a difference in how what medication would be suggested. The nonverbal signs of discomfort. You, as a family member, someone who knows this person, can be of great help to any medical caregiver, because you can read often if the person, you know, there are signs of discomfort, and maybe the other caregivers don't at this point. If, on the other hand, this person has been in a nursing home for a while, and the staff has gotten to know that person over time, they may have a better idea of a better ability to read where the patient is than family members do. There will be congestion usually. There's a kind of a gathering of fluid in the trachea at the end, and so there'll be this kind of snoring sound, sometimes called the death rattle, not the sort of thing you want to. That's also can be a very distressing thing to families, because it sounds so harsh, and it seems very uncomfortable. It just sounds like the person's uncomfortable. Again, they probably are not. And if you were to suction out that fluid, once again, you would simply be extending the dying process rather than simply letting this happen more rapidly and more naturally. So we tend not to, you know, well, depending on if you're, what sort of approach is being taken, you would probably not suction the person because all you'd be doing is prolonging the dying. I want to read this thing about decreased socialization because I mean, that's the one thing that I have found, the little vignette I told you about my brother, I think was part of what that was about when he turned from me. And that was, it felt so hard to me. The person may only want to be with a very few or even just one person. This is a sign of preparation for release and an affirming of who the support is most needed from in order to make the appropriate transition. If you are not part of this inner circle at the end, it does not mean you are not loved or are unimportant. It means you have already fulfilled your task with him or her, and it is the time for you to say goodbye. If you are part of the final inner circle of support, the person needs your affirmation, support, and permission. Giving permission is another really important part that can happen. As medical people observe deaths, you often see the dying person seeming to struggle to hold on. And there comes a point often when family members finally see that this is enough and say, you know, don't struggle anymore. It's all right. You can go. We'll be all right. And that is a very powerful moment, and it often can assist the dying person to leave with some sense of peace and closure, with having received that permission to go, the assurance that you know those they are leaving are going to be all right. Another wonderful thing to do, this is not just for the way that this occurs, but when you think about pain, the pain that someone may be going through, you want to be able to relieve that pain in whatever way that is possible. There's nothing that's particularly redemptive about suffering, going through suffering, although if some of you read the article by Lisa Cahill, Sol Cahill, there is within Christianity certainly some stream of thinking that the suffering at death that people undergo is a linking with the suffering of Christ, and that this is an important spiritual task. And there is important spiritual work at the end of life. And it may include, if that has been part of how you've understood the redemption aspect of Christ, to join into that suffering may indeed be important. For Protestants, that's not so much. That hasn't been so much in the thinking. It's a much more Catholic idea. But the pain, as I've mentioned before, it usually can be dealt with. I think the medical system is getting better and better at, and particularly through hospice, through the palliative care work that people are doing, getting better at this, controlling that without losing, you know, trying to keep as much alertness as possible. You do lose some alertness, and you do potentially hasten death somewhat by giving pain medication. But the person is dying. It's not the pain medication that causes the person's death. It's the disease. that's causing the person's death. So I did want to just talk about that a bit. After someone dies in a hospital setting, or even at home in hospice, there really is no rush. You don't have to do anything immediately. You hopefully will be invited to simply stay there and be with the person as long as you want. And there are options we'll talk about tomorrow in terms of funeral care and so on that are out there for us that we don't tend to think of because we just don't know about them. So the main thing though is that nothing has to happen. I mean, there's nothing urgent anymore. When the death has occurred. So if each one who is there could have time alone with the person, that might be good. Certainly calling people to know is important to do. But again, it's not urgent. So that's part of what I wanted to do with you tonight, to talk about those things. In terms of the pain, the other thing I wanted to mention about the pain is that pain kind of can make your, I don't know how many of you have had difficult pain, and I fortunately have not had, other than having children, have not had to deal with pain. But I know the little pain that I have takes all my attention. You know, it just fills a room, but you know, it can make your whole get sort of tiny and dense and contract and protective. And so massage, if you can have people come in to do massage, that's wonderful. Music. Music that could be played, the favorite music that you might like or the person who's dying likes. Not everybody likes Gregorian chant. A lot of people like country music and other things, you know, 60s rock or whatever that they would like to, that they find would might find comforting. And the other thing is kind of normalcy too. I mean, this is not a normal situation, and yet one of the delights in the setting that I was in the hospital with the garden room, this hospice room, was that one part of the room was like a living room and one was where the dying person was. And it was all very homey looking and so on. And families would sort of camp out in the living room area, you know, and then take turns coming in. I would think that that the normalcy of, you know, the children's voices, of some of that, you know, that when I was a child, one of the most comforting things that I remember was being in my bed and hearing people in other rooms talking and just kind of conversing, knowing I was there, safe. So I think there's a kind of normalcy that you can also be try to make as much as possible normal in the operating day. Responses, any kinds of responses here. I know these are not such easy things to remember, Golden.
I guess with my sister, when her husband was dying, and I was with another sister, and even earlier in the day, her son was urging my sister Mary to give her husband permission to go, and she said, I can't, I want him to be here. And it was very, very difficult, but finally when she said, you know, it's okay, you'll see your mom, you'll see your dad, and within minutes he died.
Really? Hmm.
It was interesting, even though my dad was unconscious, as far as in a coma. He waited till the last person was there.
He did. Those are wonderful stories when that can be the case. I mean, it doesn't always happen. But yeah, it happens enough that you have to wonder how much they're able to hold on. This is one of the reasons, I mean, one of the things that you may want to consider in your advanced directives in terms of keeping yourself alive should something happen that means your death will come soon unless you are put on a ventilator or there's something that's... There may be a kind of middle way approach where you would want, if it meant that somebody who lived in California or South America or something was going to be able to get there, or that possibility would exist, you might want to try to make that possible.
We had one sister on the way yet. But
yeah, one sister on the way. And it does happen. I mean, there's lots of heartrending stories that happened for me with my mother as well, that I didn't make it. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's important to try to go to someone's bedside when they're dying?
Yes. I do.
Important for what?
For you or for them or?
It could be important for both of you. And if it's important for one of you, it's worth it. I think that you know, you can't expect that your agenda is the dying person's agenda. And but you may need to, you know, one of the things that I said to my sister on the phone with my mother was, you know, she said, I don't think it's imminent. You know, and I said, well, I know I don't feel like I have any business that I really I don't have anything. I feel like we've done closure. I don't have anything that's unfinished here that I need to do. But then I realized afterwards I didn't know whether there was anything she needed to say to me. You know, this it turned out it just couldn't happen. She did die much faster than expected. So, so I think it is important. I mean, especially if there needs to be some reconciliation. And the other thing is just abandonment. You don't want to be. When you're dying, do you want some? Wouldn't you want people to? I don't know. What would you want?
No, I'm not sure I would.
Okay, maybe you would.
I guess if I felt that that I was causing pain to those,
mm-hmm.
to my loved ones, I wouldn't want them to have to
mm-hmm.
go through that,
mm-hmm.
the pain.
Right.
Yes. I was interesting for both my dad and my mom, especially for my mom. Somehow she must have had the premonition because she called the out-of-state children. She called the relatives the night before she died.
Mm-hmm. So she had a conversation with them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The week before during the week before she died, she called the ones who were out of state and said, don't be surprised.
Well, think how comforting that was to them then, if they weren't able to be there, you know, that they had that chance to speak with her.
And Dad gave indication somehow, too. My one sister and I said, the one out-of-state ones probably wouldn't make it, because they were going to come during that summer. But and we kept trying. I tried to say, you know, the possibility is
mm-hmm.
you won't be alive when you come.
Mm-hmm. One of the things just to remember about grief is that even after someone has died, if you have unfinished business with that person, you might need to try to I mean, depending on how powerful that need is, you might need to just get some time alone with them, to just tell them how angry you are, or how hurt you were, or how much you wished you could have told them what you really felt, or how much you loved them and you didn't get a chance to say, or even after the death. I worked with a wonderful funeral director in the town where I worked as a chaplain, and he talked about how all of the things that he had seen as the way that people dealt with their grief, family members, and how it's, he would be sure that family members who needed time alone with the person after they had died would get that. To just, if they, you know, there's some really hard stuff often that he even told a story about where he was with the person that had died. He had come to pick the body up, and one of the children had been unable to be there, and he called en route, and wisely, one of the family members said, "Hold on, she can't hear you, but at least, or maybe she can, you know, I don't know, but here, tell her what you want to say." Not telling him that she had died, but allowing him the chance to at least speak to her. And for him, it was, I mean, maybe it was a kind of charade, and yet it was a really necessary thing. And if we think about that kind of porous, I don't know, the porousness between life and death, who knows? Who knows how that works? But
my dad died suddenly, and there were 8 of us kids. Mom was still around, and 7 of us kids were able to see him in the his body in the hospital, and Mom. One was at work, and we were having a hard time getting a hold of him, and we didn't get a hold of him until after we had all left the hospital. What we didn't realize was we knew that Dad was going to be cremated. What we didn't realize was the procedure and how quickly he was being taken. And so that brother never got to see his dad.
So again, there would have been just to know what the procedure was. You know, it could have been altered. You know, if you had just had that information at hand. So it is good to just know what to expect. If you have the wherewithal to go over that when the call is made to the funeral home, to be able to say, now what kind of time do we actually have there, and what can be altered, you know, what flexibility is there.
At midnight, pretty hard to figure out who's in charge, who to call.
Sure. I mean, that's right. I mean, obviously, we're always in those situations at the time of death. One of your little sheets that I hope you took was about grief, and this session was partly on that. Did you receive any? Some of you probably didn't. The one that's got the little duck on it. Two of these both have. I wanted to. One is good. Just this image of, you know, bereaved people are like a duck above the surface, looking for clothes and unruffled below the surface, having like crazy. And then there are these others that are. I wanted to share with you, particularly because it's just a group of thoughts on grief. Little quotes, but at the bottom there's a calligraphy prayer that was written out by one of the volunteer chaplains that I supervised at the hospital. She was 99 years old, a wonderful woman who was able to give of herself really almost till the very end, very, very wonderful. So I treasure that little prayer in itself. It was one that I always loved attending to the dying and shielding the joyous. I love that phrase as well. That is part of what we do with one another in a Christian community. I would also like to invite, if any of you would be willing to stay for another 15 minutes, I would love to do with you a prayer of commendation, which is something that can be done prior to a person dying. And it is a wonderful experience, can be a wonderful experience for the person dying and for the family to be able to gather together and bid farewell, commend the person to God together as before the person's death, and give thanks to them. So if you are interested and would like to do that, I would really invite you to do that, and those of you who would like to leave at this point, you are welcome to do so. Coming, the next session we're going to have is at 4 tomorrow, and we'll be working with advanced directives and funeral planning, and I have things here for you to take tonight and maybe look over tomorrow, but for that.